Knowing how to speak and understand a new language can be an invaluable tool when traveling, meeting new friends, or just even to master a new skill. But it's not always simple when you're bogged down by textbooks and structure classes. That's why so many people trust Rosetta Stone. Rosetta Stone is the most trusted language learning program, available on desktop or as an app. It truly immerses you in the language you want to learn, like Spanish, French, Italian, Chinese, and more. You won't just be studying English translations. The Rosetta Stone intuitive process helps you pick up a language naturally, first with words, then phrases, then sentences. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/rs10. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/rs10 today.
Hey, I'm Brett Podolsky, co-founder of The Farmer's Dog. We make fresh food for dogs. We started the company when we saw what a huge difference it made in my own dog, Jada, when she stopped eating ultra-processed kibble and started eating fresh, whole food. The Farmer's Dog food isn't fancy. It's just real food delivered to your door in pre-portioned packs. It's better for them and easier for you.
Get 50% off your first box at thefarmersdog.com/podcast. That's thefarmersdog.com/podcast.
Talk is Jericho, baby. Talk is Jericho. Talk is Jericho, mama. Talk is me.
All right, welcome to Talk is Jericho. It's the Pot of Thunder and Rock and Roll, and it's Black Friday.
Black Friday! May the devil on the wall. It's Black Friday!
May the devil on the wall. Hope everyone had a great Thanksgiving and plenty of turkey, and let's get rolling with the Duff McKagan joke of the week.
Hey, Chris Jericho, Duff McKagan calling here. Hope everybody's doing well and good. I'm sitting here with my wife, Susan. She's right over here. She asked me to ask you, did you hear about the claustrophobic astronaut? Yeah, he just needed space. Thank you very much.
As if we didn't have enough turkey already. Haha, 2-for-1 Duff jokes here today. Very helpful and very thankful to Duff for bringing the last every Friday. Hope Duff and Susan and the family had a great Thanksgiving as well. And we're thankful for everyone who came out to rock with Fozzy and the Spotlight on America tour. We had a great time, and we're getting ready to bring the tour across the pond. Once again, Spotlight on the UK kicks off February 16th in Newport, Wales. Tickets to the show and to the VIP meet and greets are available now at FozzyRock.com. We've got one of the best VIP experiences in the biz. We meet you, take pictures, sign stuff, and we even let you sing. So again, FozzyRock.com has all the ticket info for the shows and the VIP meet and greet. See you in Europe in February. All right, today on the show, another Talk is Jericho first-timer and another actor-comedian making his Talk is Jericho debut. David Cross is here. David's done a lot. You know exactly who he is, Mr. Show on HBO, Waiting for Guffman with Christopher Guest, the Chipmunk movies, and one of my favorites, Tobias Fünke, on Arrested Development, one of the greatest characters in television history. And yes, we're talking the Never Nude gimmick on the show, The Condition, Never Nude. David has stories from that set and from the Waiting for Guffman set and Christopher Guest's improv comedy rules and motivations. He talks about how Mr. Show got started at HBO and the impact it had on sketch comedy. He also talks about how he got started doing stand-up as a teen, what he remembers about the first stand-up show he ever did, and how comedians like Andy Kaufman, Steve Martin, Richard Pryor, and Stephen Wright inspired his own comedy style. And of course, we're talking about his new comedy special, Worst Daddy in the World, premiering Monday night, November 27th, on Veeps, which is a very cool service. Go check that out. He shot it at the Metro in Chicago. Fozzie's played there. And now you can stream it on the Veeps app. Fozzie's been on Veeps before as well. You can get a ticket for the show or subscribe to Veeps at Veeps.com. Start your week with a multitude of laughs with David Cross, the Worst Daddy in the World, which premieres Monday on Veeps. And to give us a little taste, I got David Cross on Talk is Jericho right here, right now. Let's just jump right into it, man. Talking here with David Cross, lots to discuss. But right out of the gate, I want to ask you about working with Christopher Guest on Waiting for Guffman. Oh. Amazing scene that you had in that.
Yeah, that was like one of the first things I did. And I was very, not nervous, but just sort of, nervous isn't the right word, but like anxious and shy. I don't know. But he was, you know, a hero, comedy hero. And
sure.
And I had met him only briefly he and Eugene Levy were in this tiny little office somewhere in Hollywood, teeny. And I just met him, and it was like a weird, there was real kind of learn this or do this. He just wanted to meet, and I talked with him for like 5 minutes. Eugene Levy never said a word, and he was like 6 feet away. He just kind of looked up and went, hey. And then we talked for like 5 minutes, and that was it. And then I went, went home, and I didn't know what that was about. And then I got, here's the thing, here's the deal. It's all improvised, and here's what they want you to do or want you to play. And I remember on the plane, because it shot out of the side of Austin, Texas, on the plane, I thought of all these things for the character. I had so much time. And I was like, he'll be this and this. And what if I do this? And what if I say this? And I got to the set, and I said all that to Christopher Guest, who doesn't really give a lot away, you know?
It doesn't seem like he's very stoic, right?
Yeah, he's just sort of like, he's listening to you, but he's just reacting like this, and not, you don't see a whole lot across his face. And I don't know, like a 90 seconds of like, so I was thinking this and this and just dumb backstory shit. And then he just went, he just was like, no, don't do any of that. Yeah. And then the other thing about it was I was out in the field and the camera was kind of far away, and so was Video Village. So I was doing stuff to nobody, there's a cameraman right here, and I'm just sort of talking to the camera. There's no direction, and everybody's way over there, and I have no, I'm just going until they tell me to stop. So it was very strange.
So it basically, what kind of direction does he give you for that? Like, as far as like, just explain what these crop circles are type thing, or is there any lines that you have to hit?
It was mostly like telling me kind of a couple things I needed to hit because they paid off later. There was some reference to something that hadn't been shot yet that I wasn't aware of. So there were like two things that I had to say, but the rest of it was, you know, he was in his director's chair, and then they yell cut, and it was like a good 30 seconds to walk over to where I was in the middle of nowhere, in this field. And then he'd go, that thing you said about that, keep saying that, do that, don't do that, don't do that. Say this, say that, don't say that. And then he'd walk back, and then he'd yell action, and we'd try it again. You know, do the thing about the weather, the thing you riffed about this, don't do that. You know, just stuff like that.
So, and you mentioned that was one of the first things that you had ever done in Hollywood?
Yeah, I mean, it was, I think I'd done, gosh, I mean, not a lot. It was pre-Mr. Show. I know that. Maybe we might have been, I don't think I had filmed anything yet, like maybe a couple of things, but I'm not exactly sure where it is on the timeline. If it was Mr. Show, then we maybe had shot it, but not released it yet. I don't know. It was very, very, very early.
Well, you mentioned Mr. Show. When you look back at Mr. Show, I mean, that it's got kind of legendary status at this point of being very influential on kind of a lot of modern day comedy. Mm-hmm. What was it like when you guys were filming that at the time? Did you realize you were doing something cool, or was it just a gig trying to keep it afloat?
I mean, both, you know, I mean, there was definitely a sense, especially because our live shows, we had done live shows before we ever got the chance to do it, to shoot it. And those had become kind of, you know, the cool thing to go see and check out. And we were getting, you know, pretty quickly, we're getting celebrities and musicians. And so we kind of felt, you know, getting a lot of positive feedback, and, you know, there wasn't a ton of sketch back then. It was
right.
SNL obviously was still on. I think SCTV was gone. Kids in the Hall had just started, and there wasn't a whole lot on there. So we really had a bit of an impact because we were just sort of there wasn't a lot to choose from, and we were definitely different than In Living Color and Kids in the Hall. And I mean, we're closer to Kids in the Hall than anything, but definitely not SNL or anything like that. So you had this kind of feeling of like, oh, this is pretty cool. This is something, we're on to something here. And we knew the sketches were good. We knew the shows were good. And, you know, it hadn't really, HBO wouldn't really give you numbers. So it was cable. So you just have to trust them. And we had, I mean, our budget was nothing. So we felt like we were in a pretty good spot to continue doing, because people just sort of left us alone. We were on whatever it was, Fridays at midnight.
Right.
You know what I mean? And we had just such a tiny budget compared to the other shows. And so we felt pretty good. Like, and we got critical success. And I think we were nominated our second year. We were nominated. We got nominated for some Emmys and around the second year we started, those started coming. Where are you? I have to ask. You look like you're in the top part of a trampoline.
So I'm actually in Madison, Wisconsin. My band's on tour right now, so I'm in the venue. And the Wi-Fi was really bad in the dressing room, so I had to come upstairs and kind of like this holding area. So it's the roof that you're seeing. It's a very fancy roof.
Yeah. No, it actually looked like one of those superimposed backdrops.
Yeah, yeah, no, it's real. It's real. Hey.
Where are you in Madison? I love Madison.
We're at a place called The Annex. We're playing at The Annex tonight, which is kind of downtown area. You know how it is when you're on a tour, you get off the bus, you kind of just look around and okay, here we are today. So it's that type of vibe.
I love Madison. It's a great place to do shows too.
Is that from touring around doing stand-up?
Yeah, yeah.
And you still do a lot of stand-up now?
I literally just finished did the last show on last Saturday in Tucson, I think. Yeah, I did 72 shows.
Gosh.
It was great. I mean, I had to cancel the last one because of COVID.
The last tour?
Yeah, and I hadn't been on the road then since 2018, I think. Was the last time I was there. And I love touring. I love it. I mean, I don't like it when the travel is awful.
Right.
It's a grind, and it's even worse now because I've got a daughter who's in school now, so I don't go out for 3-4 months at a time. Now, you know, I go out for 4 or 5 days, come back for 3 days, and I've been doing it. So that, but that the screws up the routing. So there's a lot of like, you know, getting up at 7:30 so you can get to the airport and go fly to Seattle so you can make a connecting flight to Spokane and then get there and, you know, but I don't have to tech. I don't have any sound check or anything like that.
Right. How was it for you returning to the road after COVID, after not being on stage for so long? Because we all went through it. All of us went through it at some point.
I mean, it was the time from when I last did stand up to when I next did stand up to get the material ready for what was eventually the tour that was canceled. Because I had to cancel it because of the Delta Omicron variant.
Yeah.
Up again.
Right.
It was the longest I had ever gone without doing stand up since I started when I was like 18. And I started getting emotional in a way, like in my head, I was like, this is going to be embarrassing if you can cry. It's such a treat. And just getting to go out on the road, it's just one of my favorite things. I love traveling through the country. I love bringing the show to people. I love, you know, because I live in Brooklyn and there's plenty of shows here. Every night I can jump on a show, I can make my own show, and it's great and it's easy, but it makes you a little, not lazy, but just, I mean, it's just easy, you know? And I like going to, I was in Missoula, Montana, you know, a week and a half ago, and it was awesome. It was like, man, I'm so glad to, and I can't wait to get back to Missoula, Montana, or Fargo.
Right.
I'm doing shows there, you know?
I was just in Fargo a couple nights ago. Yeah, that's the cool thing too when you get to tour and see the whole country and know I can visualize Fargo and Missoula in my head right now. And you know, a lot of people don't get a chance to do that, you know, and see the world, so to speak, you know?
Yeah.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Let's go back to just a couple of things I wanted to talk about when you're talking about Mr. Show, and you mentioned Kids in the Hall and you mentioned SCTV. I'm from Canada, and obviously that was a huge part of our comedic culture. Mm-hmm. Did you get to see SCTV a lot, for example? Because I think where are you?
Oh yeah.
Where were you from?
I grew up in Georgia, but yeah, we had SCTV was on. I think it was on initially like a cable channel or something. Who would play it? Gosh. I mean, this is back, you know, this is pre-HBO and all that. So
I think at one point it made it onto late night NBC or something along those lines.
Well, there were two things. Yes, it switched over to late night NBC. But by then, I think most of the original cast was replaced. It was like,
yeah,
Tony Rosario and
Robin Duke, Tony Rosario. Yeah.
So the initial, you know, John Candy, Flaherty, Andrew Martin, Catherine O'Hara, Eugene Levy, Rick Moranis, those guys, I don't remember where I saw it, but I mean, I would have been fairly young, you know, but I remember loving it. And then Kids in the Hall, I was older. I think they came on in what, 93?
Like, yeah.
Something like that.
But a little bit earlier, actually, I think probably a little late 80s. And it was actually it was actually Cinemax. SCTV was on Cinemax.
Really?
Just, you know, yeah.
Oh, well, I didn't have Cinemax, so I don't know what it was in the States. But I definitely saw the early. I saw everything.
But yeah, Kids in the Hall was late 80s. I remember it started because I was still in college at the time. I used to watch it on Sunday nights.
In the States, it would be on?
I don't know. I'm just maybe in Canada. That's when it started. Maybe it transferred over, like you said, probably 93 or 94, maybe.
Where in Canada are you from?
Winnipeg.
Okay. I played there. Not on this last tour, but on the tour before that. You know who else is from Winnipeg? The great, legendary cinematic genius of Guy Madden.
Guy Madden?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, Winnipeg. He made a movie called My Winnipeg.
Wow. I didn't know. I thought I knew everybody from Winnipeg that had made it.
Isn't Winnipeg where the Burton Cummings Theater is?
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. That's where I played.
Yes. me too. We're Eskimo venue buddies.
Yeah.
So let's talk about you mentioned being on tour and doing the stand-up, and you have your new special coming up on Veeps, which we've also done a show on, which is kind of a pay-per-view type vibe, right?
Yeah, this will be the first time with them. I don't think they have comedy. I think they're I'm helping to launch their comedy
division.
Yes, but yeah, I know the guy who runs a comedy park, Bart Goldman, who's an awesome guy. He's a really good guy. So that was easy. That and also Netflix said no. So
it made it even easier. So when you're putting together material like this, the special is called The Worst Daddy in the World. You mentioned you have a daughter who's in school. So why is it The Worst Daddy in the World?
I was looking for a title, and like every single time, literally every single time, when I was trying to come up with a title for the tour, it was either too pretentious or too dumb, silly, punny, and nothing in between. Like, you know, the stuff I was coming up with was just, I'd be walking down the street going, oh, I know what I'll call it this. And then, like, I'd check it later and just roll my eyes, like, whatever. What a dumb, like, dumb or just, like, taking myself too seriously, that kind of thing. So, and it happens every time. And then, my daughter was yelling at me for whatever the thing was. I wouldn't let her do some dumb thing that she shouldn't be doing. And she said I was the worst daddy in the world. And I was like, there you go. There's the title. Great. Thank you.
It worked.
You still can't have a third cookie, but it came from her.
You said you started doing stand-up when you were 18 years old?
Yeah, I mean, literally 17, but it was like a week before my birthday. So I just say 18. It's easier.
Who were your influences to want to get involved in that?
Oh, man. For stand-up, it was Andy Kaufman, Steve Martin, Richard Pryor, Jonathan Winters, Lenny Bruce, Stephen Wright. Those were like the big ones.
And so were you nervous at first to go up on stage? Were you the funny guy in high school? Like,
I wasn't like... I moved around so often, like I was figuring it out the other day. I didn't go to the same school or know kids in the class until I was in sixth grade. That was the first time I went back to the same school and knew some of the kids. And so I was always the new kid up until I moved back to Georgia. I was born there and moved around a bunch and then moved back when I was nine. But so I was kind of shy, and I was also... Certainly in Georgia, I was the weird looking kid. I had a big Jufro and we were really poor, so I didn't clothes had holes and patches, and I had tape around my glasses if they broke. And I just looked like out of a modern day Dickens thing. I just looked, you know, I was clear, and there were barely any other Jewish people around at all. And so I was weird, you know, and then sometimes you'd embrace that, but mostly I was just kind of quiet. Until I felt comfortable enough to say something.
Right.
But then I was, you know, as I got older and a little more comfortable and started knowing people, I was definitely more kind of rowdy, sassy, I guess, you know, like not the greatest. I was confrontational too, but I'm just kind of like my stand-up, really. It was just a little anti-authoritarian and pushing buttons kind of thing. And the first time I did stand up, I was so nervous. I almost fainted. I almost got like hot flash kind of thing where I thought I was going to faint. And I was really, really, really nervous. And the guy, I wish I could remember his name. He was hosting, super sweet, super nice and encouraging. And he was really helpful. He was a juggler. Remember that, but he was very nice. And the oddest thing, like you couldn't script it this way. It was just crazy, but I crushed. I mean, it was like something in a movie, you know, I'd never done stand up and right. My material was just stuff that and it was ridiculous. And they like, oh, the red light's on. I got to go. No, stay. I mean, it's crazy. And then of course, what should have happened after that for like the next, you know, 35 times I went up and I bombed. I mean, I just ate it. I bombed and it was confusing, but it was very strange, but I'll never forget it. I just killed. I was like, oh my God, I'm a genius. I'm born to do this.
Yeah, yeah.
I should go to New York. I should get an agent, you know, whatever. And of course I ate it.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
So let me ask you this then. So I would assume, like, what's the difference between killing it and bombing it? Is it the crowd who shows up that night? Did you try and change your material that didn't work? Like, why did you bomb so many times after being so great the first time?
It remains to this day, it's different factors. Sometimes I think I'm also very honest about whether it was me or the audience or the venue. Sometimes it's the venue. The venue, not a lot, but the venue can really make a difference. Like,
really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I did a show in Manchester in England, and I always do well in Manchester, and it was a new venue. And it's my audience at this point. They're not, it's nobody's coming going like, oh, I'm going to go see a comedy show. Who's this guy?
Right.
All right, here's $45. You know, people are there to see me. They're familiar with my work. I often have to think, like, if I don't have a great set, is it me? Is it the audience? Is it a venue? Is it some combination of two or out of three of those? And, you know, again, I think I'm pretty honest with when I'm just off. Sometimes, and nobody at this point is going to go, you suck. That was a terrible show. But you can tell a difference. There's the great shows where everything clicks and it's all good and everybody's kind of in tune. And I mean, you know this.
Sure.
There's an unspoken connection and you can go out. And I've also really been wrong a number of times where I'll prejudge. I'll look at the venue. I'll look at the audience coming in. I'm going, oh, this is going to suck. It's a bunch of like older white people. And then it's great. And vice versa, where I'm like, oh, this is going to be fun. And it's just a struggle. Sometimes people are really drunk and you got to kind of babysit. You know, it's like, again, not a lot, but the show I did in Bozeman was like everybody loved it. But I don't want to be on stage more than an hour and a half. I think that's ideally I'd be up for an hour and 15, but everything expands. And I'm very, you know, I riff a lot and I'll talk to people and stuff. So, but there were so many like drunk women, and that was also odd. It was all women and like the front. And I know what the tickets are in the front too. Like, I know you paid a lot of money to come here, but you're like, that's not what I was saying, you know, whatever. And you're like, you gotta, can't be so loud, you know, whatever. It just messes up the bit. And by then you've got the cadence and delivery and the timing and all that stuff. And it's like, look, I'll do crowd work if you want. I'll make fun of you and you can feel like shit for the rest of the evening.
Right, right.
You paid the money, but, you know.
That's interesting. I never thought about it. You said you had to babysit if they're too drunk. that probably kind of throws off the bit, like you mentioned, throws off your act by having to placate these people.
Yeah, it's less about placating them and more about trying to make the decision, you know, as soon as it's happening, of like, how can I let this go and just plow through? Or do I need to nip this in the bud? Or how much can I, if I ignore it, will it go away? And, you know, that's all based on decades and decades of experience. You just try to, and sometimes you're wrong, but, you know, you're just like, if I engage, then I'm engaging. Mm-hmm. And then I've opened the doors to that, unless I shut it down quickly. And I'm really, I mean, I count on one hand the time I've kicked people out, or I really try not to do that. I try to just address it. And I'm not talking about people who are heckling me. I'm talking about people who are participating,
right,
you know, helping right. me, being part of the show.
Yeah.
You know? Or like some people, it's almost like a Tourette's, but some people just yell out things they think are funny when I've set up, when I'm asking a question that's rhetorical, because I know what the answer is. The answer is coming, and the answer is the fucking punchline.
Right.
So well, don't yell out Trump, you know, or like that. You know?
No, but you get that. I had that last night. We did a show in Lansing, Michigan, and there's one guy in the crowd yelling something, just talking over him in between songs, because I know if I stop and acknowledge this person, I don't even know what they're saying. I don't want to know, because it's not fitting into what my vision for this overall presentation is.
Absolutely. Yeah. And again, you know, I mean, I don't have like, I can't turn up an amp to hit a power cord to drown them out.
Right.
So anytime I'm pausing, you know, for effect, that some people see an opportunity to yell dumb shit out. And again, it's not a lot. It doesn't happen a lot, but enough. So that's where the babysitting part. And again, I really don't want to kick people out. I know some comics are like quick to go, get them out, security, whatever.
You've done so much stuff in Hollywood, kind of going back to your early days. What would you consider to be like one of your first big breaks in your career was?
I mean, there are a couple really, you know, if you looked on a timeline, there are a handful where you go, that was huge. And the first big thing where everything switched was I'd gotten a manager through Stephen Wright. It was Stephen Wright's manager, and a mutual friend of ours I was good friends with her, and we were doing this comedy group in Boston, and she said, you should check out this guy. And Stephen came down and saw a set I did, and he referred me to his manager, who was living in New York. He came up, watched me do stand-up, and signed me. His name was Tim Sarkis. And then, because of that, I got into the Just for Laughs Festival in Montreal, which is the biggest comedy festival on the planet. It's been around for, I don't know, 40 years, something crazy like that. And it's huge.
Yeah.
It's a month long. Right. And it's great. And so I got to do that. And then, you know, you're put on a bunch of different shows, and, you know, you'll do like 6 or 7 shows throughout the week or so. And I did this one show, I can't remember what it was called. It was like The Danger Zone, or, you know, whatever it was. It was Naughty Time or whatever. And I remember doing the set, and it was, you know, packed, and it's tons of industry. And there's, you know, I don't know, 800 people, 700, I don't know. And I fucking killed, and I crushed, and I did weird stuff. And I did, you know, what I do, or did, I should say. And it was sort of like the buzz the next day. It was a big deal. And Charles Jaffe was Woody Allen and David Letterman's manager. I was like, he was quoted in the paper, like, this is a kid to watch, and blah, blah, blah. And everything shifted after that. And then the next big change was getting a job writing on the Ben Stiller Show. Janine Garofalo is an old friend from Boston, from stand-up, and she got my sketch packet to those guys, to Judd and Ben. And I'd met Ben. Ben and Janine and I went out for drinks before I had the show, so I had a little bit, you know, he knew who I was. And then I moved to L.A., and I was thrown into Hollywood, a place I'd never really been to before. And, you know, it was trial by fire, because the show was already up and running when I replaced somebody else. And it was a huge learning experience, and also brought me down quite a few pegs too, because I kind of had this attitude of like, I'm a stand-up is pure comedy.
True artist. Yeah.
Yeah. And like, 20, whatever, however old I was. And then, and I met Bob Odenkirk there, although we did not, we weren't friends at first, but then we became friends. And then there was Mr. Show, which I would say is the third piece of the puzzle, the third thing that changed everything. And then from there, there were like smaller things that happened, but those were the three big things that super sped up my career and got me to the next level quickly.
Were you surprised, quickly, as you mentioned Bob Odenkirk, how successful he became with Better Call Saul?
No,
he's such a great actor in that part.
He's a great actor, and I mean, there are, and I said this even before Breaking Bad, but there are some sketches he's in, and Mr. Show, that it's undeniably good acting. Like, even though it's a comedy bit and it's a grounded bit, like, there's just really good acting. Even though it's a 4-minute ridiculous comedy sketch, you believe his character. You have empathy for him, and he brings kind of a humanity to him. So I'm not surprised at all.
At Alma, we know the connection between you and your therapist matters. But if you're already feeling stressed and burnt out, the idea of trying to find a therapist you really connect with can be overwhelming. That's why Alma's focused on helping you find the right therapist for you. When you browse their online directory, you can filter your search based on the qualities that are most important to you. Then you can book a free 15-minute consultation call with any therapist you're interested in seeing, so you can get a feel for whether they're the right fit before you commit to a full-length session. Alma also makes it easy for mental health care providers to navigate insurance. That's why 95% of therapists in their directory accept insurance for sessions, so you can find care that's affordable without stressing about the paperwork. You want to talk to someone, but not just anyone. Alma is there to help you find the right fit. Visit helloalma.com/therapy60 to schedule a free consultation today. That's helloalma.com/therapy60.
To me, what put you on the map, and for me, was Arrested Development, of course,
right.
Tobias Fiumke, one of the all-time greatest characters in television history, in one of the greatest shows in television history. So kind of talk us about how you got that part, because there were so many comedic geniuses involved in that show, and I would put you in that category as well with what you did with that character.
Well, yeah, that was very special. We all knew it was special when we were shooting the pilot. Originally, I had... Are you guys drum teching?
Sound checking, so I'm muting myself so it doesn't mess you up too much. Sorry.
Because I was going to say, you got to bring the pitch on the floor, Tom, up a little bit.
Front of House by David Cross for today's sponsor show.
I had just moved to New York. I had been in L.A. for 9 years. I did not care for it, and I never wanted to be there. I needed to be there for work, but I'm not an LA
right.
type person. It's not for me. And I wanted to move to New York and found an opportunity where there was just a break in my work schedule. I'm like, if I don't leave now, I'm going to be stuck here for another 3-4 years.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
Moved to New York, got an apartment, had a girlfriend, just loving life. It was just great. And then I got, you know, my manager said, there's this new show that their Fox is going to do. And it's this guy, Mitch Hurwitz, and it's really great. And you should check it out. I was like, I don't even send it. I'm not interested. I'm not going to go back to LA and work. I just don't want it. Just please check it out. And then even Naomi Odenkirk, Bob's wife, made a pitch for it. Like, you should really check it out. So I got the script and it was great. The script is really funny. They wanted me to look at the Job and Buster characters, which...
Wow.
Yeah, and a Job I had no handle on at all. I didn't know what they were looking for. But then there's this... Tobias has kind of a... And Tobias was always meant to be like a recurring character, not a regular cast member. He was in like 6 episodes or so. And Tobias was like... I immediately got this guy, knew who he was, and that's who I wanted to play. And also, like, the idea of, like, not being a cast member, regular cast member, was really exciting. You know,
it's right, like, right.
I can live in New York and I don't have to move to LA for another, you know, 4 or 5 months a year. And so I talked to Mitch and I talked to the directors on the phone and I gave him my idea and I said, I'm really interested in Tobias and this is how I see him. And I described what he looked like and what he wore and all this stuff. And they're like, great. fantastic. And I was like, okay, so I'll be a part-time guy. I'll play Tobias. I'll come in and out. Awesome. Everybody's happy. So I went to shoot the pilot a little while later, and I remember very well being on that a little bridge. Are you familiar with LA? You know, the Beverly Center?
Yeah.
Across from the Beverly Center is the Beverly Connection. And there's like this little bridge in the back, this little like walkway, I should say.
Yeah.
And I was on there and I called my girlfriend, who is very much New York. And I said, hey, I think I have to do this show and I have to, it's really pretty cool. And it's something special. And I think I have to be a regular on it. And I'm going to have to move here. I remember making that call going, this is really something special. So we all knew it. It was really cool. And everything about it, the direction, meeting Mitch, his personality, the writing, the ability to improvise, it was just, and also the cast, I wasn't familiar with really anybody. I knew Jessica and Jeffrey and Jason's sort of face, you know, but
sure, yeah.
I wasn't, and I didn't know Will or Tony or Michael or Alia and Portia, and it was just really fun, and the casting is just perfect on that show.
It really is.
And again, there was like day four, that feeling that we all had, and we were getting to know each other. Like, this is pretty awesome. You know, this is a rare experience, you know?
I love some of the things that Tobias did over the course of the time. You mentioned there was a lot of improv. Obviously, the Never Nude is one of the greatest bits ever. Who came up with that? Was that written for you? Did you come up with that?
Oh, no, that was good. I mean, you know, there was improvising in the beginning, but pretty quickly, the scripts were so dense and so packed, and the scripts got bigger. And I mean this in a literal way. The scripts got bigger and longer, and our time was shrinking. Like, every year, Fox would cut off another 30 seconds to sell for ads. So,
oh, wow.
You know, initially it was like whatever it was. I'm pulling these numbers out of my ass, but it was like 24 minutes an episode. And then that got cut down. By the time we were done, it was like 21 minutes. And
oh, wow.
25 minutes. Like, they kept cutting time every year. But the scripts were getting longer. So any improv stuff was usually cut.
Mm.
Scenes, like you would shoot for a day, you'd shoot a scene, and then it would be, you'd go into ADR later after everything's posted, and then the scene would be reduced to like a cut on your back, and you'd have to say something like, I'll get the door or something, just to, right. You know.
Never Nude is a great bit. I also love the fact that Tobias wanted to be in the Blue Man Group. Mm-hmm. And you would see the random fucking blue handprints all over the house, just like randomly placed.
Yeah.
Yeah. Some good stuff with that. So what about season four, when you did the entire, it was kind of over the course of the same period of time. That was very inventive as well for that.
Yeah. I mean, I loved the idea of it. I watched it and it took me about kind of 6 or 7 episodes, like right when I was getting to like Tobias's story, to really understand how to watch it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I really started to enjoy it more. I mean, I was enjoying it, but it was a little disconcerting, but it definitely took kind of getting used to it and going, oh, I see how to watch this now. And I loved it, loved the idea, loved the execution of it, and kind of bummed. I get it, but I'm kind of bummed that Netflix took that version off the air and then just did the chronological version. Like,
right.
When you go see it, you can't see that version anymore.
Oh, really? It doesn't exist?
I don't think so. It's too bad. It was really inventive and, you know, paid off. It was one of those things you kind of had to invest a little time in. And again, it took me a good 6 or 7 episodes to go, oh, I know how to watch this now. I see how this works.
It's interesting, too, because it was like 8 years after the first couple seasons.
Yeah.
Was it easy to get back into that character again after such a long time?
Yeah, absolutely. I could do it now very quickly. It's just and especially, this is going to sound like I'm joking, but honestly, when I put the mustache on, it's like, that is the thing that can really just drive it home. If I look in the mirror and I see that mustache, that's specific. You know, you get the glue on, you put the mustache on and the glasses and like, oh, there's the device. But as I said, it's kind of based on two different archetypes that I, you know, one being East Coast and one being West Coast. And I just, yeah, I know exactly who that guy is. I don't like him.
You don't like Tobias?
No, I mean, I like him, but I would just be calling that guy on his shit constantly. Like, he's just so annoying, but annoying because he's so pretentious and full of himself and self-centered, even though he claims not to be.
And that's the problem with that whole show, though. All those characters are kind of like that. It was a very unlikable family, for sure.
Oh, yeah. So, and incredibly self-absorbed, you know, except for George Michael and maybe and Michael, I'd say.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial. And with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown. And through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
Let's talk about another one of your movies that I really enjoyed, which was the stuff that you did with the Chipmunks and how huge that franchise was. Did you expect that when you guys started doing it?
Nobody did. No, nobody thought that movie was going to become a quite literally billion-dollar franchise. No.
Is that what it was, billion-dollar?
Over a billion dollars, yeah. Internationally. Dude, I have been in some of the most like odd, random, and often remote parts of the world, and people have gone like, you know, the Chipmunks, or you know, I'm telling you, everywhere. China. I was in Mozambique on the Indian Ocean, like in a tiny remote place, good to go scuba diving. I mean, there's nobody there. There's nothing. And I was in I was on a ferry boat in Turkey. I mean, just like the craziest places. And people will be like, the Chipmunks. Yeah, you stole the Chipmunks. I get that a lot. What's weird is that I'm that was a long time ago, but so many now they're adults. Like the people who were kids who were way into that, these adults will come up to me and go like, oh man, Chipmunks was huge, man. I love that. You stole the Chipmunks, you know? And it's just weird to hear it from an adult because I was so used to kids all the time going, you stole the Chipmunks.
What did you think when that was pitched to you? I mean, obviously, that's the cool thing about Hollywood. You get all these different opportunities, and sometimes it seems a little bit crazy what you're hearing, but what did you think about it?
Well, it was the opposite, really. I hadn't worked in 6 months, which is psychologically, it's really hard. First couple months, you're not, all right, whatever, something will come around. By month four, you're like, what's going on? And you start thinking, am I unhirable? Does nobody want to work with me? 5 months in, you know, and then, so it had been 6 months since I had worked, and I love working. And if I had a steady thing, I don't think I would have done it, but I really, 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 you know, I wanted to work, and it wasn't my ideal project, but it was, I was happy to have the work. And, you know, the first one was fun. First one was, an enjoyable, had a, you know, really good director. It was fun. And I did enjoy it. And they let me improvise all three of those movies. I riffed at least 20 to 30% of all the stuff you see in dialogue. I mean, I just came up with that. So that was fun too, you know, and also, you know, once I signed that contract, as I said, nobody expected it to be that big of a franchise, but you know, I was contractually obligated, like, well, now you got to do as many as they want you to do. You got to do at least three.
Oh, really? Is that how it was? They kind of lock you in there?
Cause I mean, I didn't think it was going to be, not that I wouldn't have signed it anyway. I mean, I happily signed the contract, did the work, but yeah, I didn't anticipate I'd be doing two more, but yeah.
It's interesting that you said you didn't have work for 6 months because you've been working steady basically since Mr. Show. I thought that, you know, Why does something like that happen, do you think, sometimes?
You know, just a confluence of different events, I suppose. You know, and you're not the same. Like, if I'm going out for certain roles, I've aged out of that, or I, you know, you're just not right for that guy anymore, that part. And then you start doing these different things. And it was just one of those, I don't know, just didn't work. And it
just happens, right?
Yeah. And there's no like, it would almost be easier if people said, you know, oh, they don't like you.
right.
And then, you know, I worked pretty steadily. But that's kind of the nature of the business, is you'll go through a lot of work. You know, it's when it rains, it pours. And then when it stops, sometimes it stops for a while. And, you know, and I'll always have stand up, you know, so I'll be working at something.
Well, and that's how kind of it goes in Hollywood. And something else that I noticed that you've done a lot of as we start to wind down here is voiceover work. Your voice is in so many different projects. How do you approach that type of a role?
That is, it's really just, you know, you ask people what they're looking for, and almost always it's like, oh, just, you know, there'll be a description in the script, but mostly it's like, don't try to do too much, just do you. And and that's usually what it is, the direction. Then you're just being you're just turning it up a little bit because it's animated, so something that you might deliver on camera a little more placidly becomes a little more, you know, hyped up and energetic and just bigger. It's really fun to do. I enjoy doing voice work. It's pretty cool. I like it.
Yeah. It would seem like, you know, you have to, do you ever change the voice up a bit? Like, you know, add some gruffness to it. I guess it all depends on what.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, you do that until people go like, you know what, don't just do yourself, you know, or do more like Tobias, or do, you know, make him more nervous or nerdy sometimes.
Last few things for you, David. I mean, like I said, you've done so many things. What are some of your favorite characters that you've played? I mean, obviously, we've talked about Tobias. We've talked about the Chipmunks. But besides those types of parts?
Well, certainly Tobias is up there. There was a character I did on Mr. Show a bunch that we made a movie about. And that was based on stuff I used to do in my stand-up, which is just a redneck, drunk, dumb redneck guy, which I used to just do in high school, just do the voice. But on Mr. Show, it was Ronnie Dobbs. But that's a really fun, that's easy. I mean, I could just do that in my sleep.
Mm.
Dumb, drunk, redneck. So I got that down. there was a character I did in a movie where I was more of the straight man. And there's like a big twist at the end, which was really enjoyable to do. And like, some of the other cast, the other comic heavy lifting. And I just, I enjoyed being that kind of grounded. And it's a movie called It's a Disaster. And he is a stranger to this group of people who are all friends, having this brunch that just devolves into chaos. And I'm like somebody's date. And so that was really fun to do. Todd Margaret, of course, was really, really enjoyable. Just the world's dumbest man. He's just so dumb. And he's also cocky when he shouldn't be cocky. And just, you know, the full title is, there it is right there. The Increasingly Poor Decisions of Todd Margaret. And just every choice he makes is just stupid. And he's faux well-meaning, but he's not. He's really, it's just about himself. But it's kind of, if you go into that going, okay, this is the world's dumbest guy, and it's really fun. He was fun to play. I mean, you know, even Ian Hawke, just a douchebag, you know, an asshole in the Chipmunk movies, that was fun, you know, just being a jerk.
When you did that part, obviously there's a lot of, you know, chipmunks that are being constructed post in post. Were you talking a lot to a green screen, or did they have a little puppet there that you could talk to? Or
yeah, the process was really long, and there were several steps. So you would, I don't know if I'm getting all the chronological sequencing right, but you'd initially do it. You'd do the scene, and then they would have tennis balls on the end of these like long sticks, and somebody would be there to kind of map out the route that if I'm talking to this chipmunk and there's another guy bouncing around and I have to go, hey, stop that. They they do that so you can get some, kind of where your eyes are supposed to be.
Right.
You know, so there's one in front of me on my hand, and then they're da-da. So you go through that a number of times, then they have to take those away. Then I think they put things there. Then they take those away. Then I think you shoot. And then they put this amazing, like, 360-degree kind of mirror ball type camera in the center, which shoots everything. It's crazy. Mm-hmm. The technology is nuts. And then you do it again. I think you do it again with the little tennis balls. Then you do it again without anything there. And then, you know, you obviously have to redo it if you're looking the wrong way. And I remember in the second movie, there's a scene where I'm in like a apartment complex, and I'm shoving I'm either taking the chipmunk out of the mail slot or shoving them through or something like that. And we had to do that for 2 hours because they're like, oh, your hands are too, your hands have to be exact. There's a camera right here. Your hands have to be in the exact place because right. If they're too big, then the chipmunk is too big and your hand won't be right. If it's too short, then you're like choking and your fingers are inside the chipmunk. It was crazy. And so, and there was movement to it. So your hands can't change the shape for this like couple of seconds. It took like, you know, almost 2 hours.
Did you ever think when you were 18 that your legacy would be a never nude with the CGI chipmunks?
Yes.
it's the American dream, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah.
Last thing for you, man. Worst Daddy in the World. It's coming up on November 27th. You've done a lot of specials. Obviously, this one's a little different with Veeps. You still love doing these types of specials? And how much do you have to prepare for it? Because I would assume you want to make sure that you nail it, but you still want to keep it a little bit loose.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, there's no preparation other than, you know, I always tape the special midway through the tour. Because at that point, I've done the set, you know, 35, 40 times at that point. And, you know, you just shoot, I shot two shows at the Metro in Chicago. You know, you have a 7:30 show and a 10 o'clock show or whatever. And you just shoot two shows.
One of the dudes has his baby on there. You got it all till you get the drum check. You got the guitar check. I asked them to stop making noise. And then the little baby's running around. So you never know what you're going to get, Dave.
Never know.
Well, man, I appreciate talking to you. It's been a blast. And once again, big fan of all the stuff that you've done. And congratulations on your new special.
All right, man. Thank you very much.
Appreciate it, dude. See you
soon. Have a good show. Have a fun set. Enjoy.
Thanks,
Madison.
Man. Stop streaming, kid. Thanks, dude.
All right, man.
Bye.